Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the dog days of summer are here. It is hot, hot, hot out there.
It certainly is. We've been getting one heat wave after another here in Connecticut. We hope everyone's taking good care of themselves.
Well, speaking of hot places, the governors of the nation got together at their annual meeting of the National Governors Association. And guess what? One of the hot topics of discussion was there.
That wouldn't be hard at all. And the echoes of the Supreme Court's decision on the Affordable Care Act just keep reverberating loudly through state houses across the nation. I hear there were lively debates and two pretty distinct camps at the governor's gathering.
Those who say they will hold out for enacting certain aspects of the health care law, like expanding Medicaid and forming insurance exchanges for individuals and small businesses, I think were the two topics.
And those who are already hard at work implementing the ACA's directives, still pretty much a partisan divide on the topic of health care reform, Mark, with the opposition coming largely from the GOP. But we should note that some Democratic governors expressed concern about expanding Medicaid as well, noting that their budgets are already under extreme duress.
The economy has hit most states pretty hard, and governors are concerned about controlling expenses, even if it means expanding health coverage for more of their vulnerable populations.
Well, Mark, we should remind folks that the Medicaid expansion portion of the Affordable Care Act is going to be completely funded by the federal government for the first decade, so states will have plenty of financial support in their efforts to expand Medicaid coverage. Still seems more political than financial when you look at it that way.
I think you're right. And we don't need a crystal ball to see that this discussion will be ongoing for some time.
But at least we're past the Supreme Court decision.
That
and
we
for
are.
That, we are grateful. Speaking of seeing into the future, Mark, our guest today is somebody who is practiced at the art of predicting and gazing into the future. Futurist Dr. Clement Beazold is the chairman and co-founder of the Institute for Alternative Futures, a leading research organization that makes long-term predictions on what the future, and in this case, the healthcare of the future, is going to look like.
He'll be talking about his organization's latest report on what healthcare is going to look like in this country in the year 2025 and beyond. He'll also look into the growing impact technology is going to have on healthcare delivery.
And FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson uncovers the truth behind yet another misstatement from the campaign trail regarding healthcare.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have a comment, email us at chcradio.com or send a message on Facebook at Conversations on Healthcare. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll get to our guest, Dr. Clement Beazold, in just a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. Taxpayers and the healthcare law. Who will pay? According to a report out by the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, middle-income earners will see relatively little additional burden as a result of the law. The Affordable Care Act is projected to raise about $800 billion in revenues over the next 10 years, but the bulk of that money will come from corporations and households earning more than $200,000 per year. About 7 million people could pay more because the law makes it more difficult to deduct medical expenses. About 4 million workers could pay more because of a new $2,500 limit on flexible spending accounts, which can be used to shield medical expenses from taxation. Several small taxes, such as the one on indoor tanning salons, also could reach average taxpayers. Still, fewer than 10% of the nation's 140 million tax filers are likely to pay more. Meanwhile, a recent Gallup poll shows the nation is pretty much split on how they view the impact of the health care law. A slight majority think the law will improve things for most Americans, especially those who are sick or uninsured. At the same time, Americans say the law will make things worse rather than better for taxpayers, businesses, and doctors. The amount of trans fats consumed by New Yorkers has fallen significantly since the city banned the sale of foods containing trans fats in 2007. According to a recent report, there's been an average drop of 40 trans fat calories per day consumed by the average New Yorker, which may not seem like a lot, but it's a significant reduction when taken over time. Health analysts say that even a moderate daily consumption of trans fats, 23 calories per day, leads to higher incidence of heart disease. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
We're We're speaking today with Dr. Clement Beazle, co-founder, chairman, and senior futurist at the Institute for Alternative Futures, which was formed in 1977 to encourage anticipatory democracy and to analyze global trends, particularly in the future of healthcare and other social issues. Dr. Beazle is the author of more than 10 books, as well as the author of numerous forecast and research papers, and is the consulting editor of the Journal of Future Studies. Dr. Beazle, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Beazle, you founded the Institute for Alternative Futures, along with the noted author of Future Shock, Alvin Toffler. That groundbreaking book, published in 1970, analyzed how society is undergoing an enormous structural change. And this accelerated rate of technological and social change is really quite overwhelming to the society. Technology is revolutionizing so many aspects of our lives, especially in the delivery and use of healthcare. Help us understand the key ideas of Future Shock and the changes in technology as it relates to healthcare.
Yeah, Alvin Toffler published it in 1970. He'd been writing it during the course of the 60s. And what he anticipated, what he saw, was the speed of change as we were moving from an industrial society to an information society, and that there was a stress of this degree and pace of change that is future shock. And he identified his prescription for it was anticipatory democracy. But in health, what he anticipated was and identified eustress, which was good stress, and health affecting negative stress. And that was part of the biggest aspect that he identified. In more recent years, there are a whole host of issues about genomics, about genetic engineering, about artificial intelligence that are increasing the pace of change. And so that the threat of future shock remains out there.
So, Dr. Beazle, as a futurist, you've looked into the future from here and done some long-term projections on everything from the impact that we will realize of the diabetes crisis to the future of community health centers, and also predicted what primary care is likely to look like in 2025 and beyond. And you, of course, use some pretty sophisticated predictive techniques to do that. So what's your unique approach to forecasting these trends? How do you arrive at the conclusions that you do, and maybe share some of those predictions with us?
Basically, there's agreement that you look at the experts, you understand what the current trends are, you identify key drivers of change, you forecast those, and you do that both with experts looking at the literature. But what we add then is you ask both what is likely to happen given current trends, but also what challenges are out there, what could go wrong, and then finally ask what visionary or surprisingly successful outcomes would look like. And so you then use the forecasts and scenarios to paint a path to what's expectable or most likely, what's challenging or difficult, and what's visionary or successful. And you put all those three together. That leads in healthcare to fairly different forecasts for healthcare itself.
Now, the Institute for Alternative Futures recently produced a report with support from the Kresge Foundation entitled Primary Care 2025, a Scenario Exploration. Now, that explores several different views of what primary care could look like in 2025 and beyond, from a low zone of growing desperation to a zone of high aspiration. But tell us a little more about the partners who participated with you in crafting this document, and how did this come about?
The Kresge Foundation does a lot in primary care, and they agreed to fund these scenarios. We partnered with the National Association of Community Health Centers, NAC, and David Stevens was one of our major partners. But for the Primary Care 2025 report, we actually started interviewing experts, and 56 experts later, we had gotten very rich sets of input. We then went to 10 primary care provider groups, Kaiser Permanente, Group Health, the Surgeon General of the Air Force, Surgeon General of the Army, small clinics, and put in front of them various forecasts and said, how will your primary care, what will it be in 2025, what will it look like? Use those focus groups to help us develop those scenarios as well.
Dr. Beazle, I'd like you to spend some time maybe sharing with us these scenarios that you've developed. And I understand there's sort of four likely scenarios that you envision. Maybe we could just look at the first two of them for a moment. And you title them Many Needs, Many Models, and the second, Lost Decade, Lost Health. Maybe you could share a little bit about those scenarios with our listeners.
Yeah, the first, Many Needs, Many Models, is sort of the extrapolation of where we're going now. Ultimately, we get some additional movement into integrative systems. We still have a lot of fee-for-service. Primary care moves to the patient-centered medical home. But we also get a large influx by 2025 of digital health coaches. And what that is the capacity to have each individual, often through their provider, but sometimes buying on their own, in effect an expert physician, the way that IBM's Computer Watson beat humans in Jeopardy. We're going to have Doc Watson and other things like that that take all knowledge, personalize it to you, and will personalize our vital signs. That will be integrated into healthcare, and it will have very rich primary care teams, including greater emphasis on nurse practitioners. Scenario two is lost decade, lost health. And that's, you know, the challenge is that we could be going in for a double dip recession or worse, depending on a variety of things. This scenario assumes that we don't get our act together, we don't get healthcare reform. Many healthcare providers actually go out of business, including many community health centers. We do get advances in this second scenario, including cures for Alzheimer's. The challenge is they tend to be very expensive. So the $60,000 a year cure for Alzheimer's is great for rich people, but most people don't get it. And that minute clinics become more important, emergency rooms stay important, particularly for those people who don't have access to community health centers.
We're speaking today with Dr. Clement Beazle, chairman and senior futurist at the Institute for Alternative Futures, the leading organization that provides industry forecast for policymakers and stakeholders in healthcare and other social disciplines. Let's pull the thread a little more on those primary care models. There are two other scenarios that you predict which seem to incorporate some ideas central to the themes of the Affordable Care Act. And the third scenario is primary care that works for all, which focuses on the triple aim of healthcare reform. And the fourth scenario, I am my own medical home, which you call a surprisingly successful integrated care model. Can you tell us a little more about those two scenarios?
Yeah, scenario three, primary care that works for all, and it says we want to lower per capita cost while we increase the excellence of healthcare experience and we increase population health. That leads to a movement of primary care from the patient-centered medical home to this community-centered health home. But it also focuses on the community. It analyzes community conditions. And healthcare providers become, along with other community partners, community health advocates for shaping the social determinants of health. We get community health workers going into people's homes, supported by the digital health coach and advanced practice management. We also do community mapping in ways that say, you know, where are the hotspots for ill health, many of which involve the social determinants of health beyond clinical care. Scenario four is I am my own medical home. And what that says is we don't get quite the assurance that we did in scenario three that you'll never spend more than 10% of your income on your health care insurance. And so consumer-directed health plans where you pay out of pocket for the first several thousand dollars become the norm for about 40% of the population. The good news in this context, and why we called it I Am My Own Medical Home, is that those 40% have very powerful tools for doing their own self-management, self-care. They also have transparency so that if they want to go and buy something, they know the success rate of the doctors and the primary care teams in their community. They know from, there's now a group called Patients Like Me. In this scenario, it evolves to SNPs Like Me, the basically segments of your gene that define certain health conditions. Those are grouped together in a way so that you're getting advice from people who have conditions very much like you, who've gone shopping for doctors. So all of that transparency and knowledge will come together.
It's very interesting. We've just in the last month at our annual Weizmann Symposium had leaders both from the retail clinic movement and from Patients Like Me join us as really exemplars of disruptive innovations in healthcare. But let's talk for a few minutes about community health centers. Tell us why you've concluded that community health centers figure so significantly in the future of healthcare and the future of primary care.
We have a major health equity project at the Institute for Alternative Futures, and in looking for innovations about 8 years ago, identified the collaboratives within community health centers as one of the most significant quality improvement, disparity-reducing advances in U.S. healthcare. And that has led us to pay attention to this, to health centers and their unique role in providing both increasing quality, team-based care, while serving poor, marginalized populations. The job of a community health center is to increase access not only to health care, but to services and resources for the people they serve. And the people who first founded community health centers, particularly Dr. Geiger, had had the experience of community-oriented primary care working as an intern in Africa, where there was not a separation between what the primary care providers did and how they worked to improve community conditions. So the way we put it is that working on the social determinants of health is in the DNA of community health centers.
And one of the issues that health centers have to address is in healthcare is the sort of lack of effective public policy directing the training of healthcare workforce for tomorrow. And you note in your primary care 2025 that there is an oncoming shortage of primary care physicians. And same time, we're seeing an uptick of those who are seeking nurse practitioner and physician assistant diplomas. And you predict the growth of increase of community health workers and digital health coaches. Talk to us a little bit about how do you see the impact on public policy of in training the next generation of healthcare providers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in effect, the forecast for the shortage of primary care physicians really varies from scenario to scenario. But the public policy questions, we do massive support to train physicians and in particular give them residencies in hospitals when they should be getting residencies in for primary care in particular, those settings where they're actually going to practice.
We agree.
And hooray for community health centers again because of the programs they have that are using community health centers as residency sites. But that's for physicians. The issue for us and the scenarios tend to support the notion that primary care physicians will become, in effect, the caregiver for the complex primary care patient, and that increasingly people in the team, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, will become important as prime providers. And a community health worker is someone who comes from the community, shares the community's values, understands what's going on. In most cases, they're not a college graduate, but they do provide a number of important functions. In fact, Health Affairs had a recent article where a community health worker type approach was able to save significant money by doing home visits. When we put that together with the enhanced aids and digital coaching we'll have, the community health worker could be significant. Right now, federal policy is geared to generate more physicians in more specialties. That needs to be adjusted to focus on nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and this new category or this growing category of what's the role of the community health worker. The policy needs to shift.
In all of these projected new healthcare models, there certainly seems to be one recurring theme, and that's of the empowered patient. You recently, on PBS, I think, had a hypothetical patient of the future that you talked about, Mary, an uninsured 50-year-old patient with diabetes who strongly engages in her own healthcare management and does it really pretty effectively. Describe Mary's situation for us and how technology is going to make it easier for her to be an empowered, effectively self-managed patient as we go through this big transitional period that's ahead of us.
So Mary's situation varies across the four scenarios. So in the first, she's got the digital health coach. She's got diabetes, but it's under control. Her primary team member in scenario one is a nurse practitioner, but she does have health insurance. Scenario two, she does not have health insurance, and she doesn't have a regular physician, so she uses the Minute Clinic in the emergency room. She has access to digital coaches, but she can't afford to buy one, so she gets the ones that are for free. There will be free digital health coaches, and they may not be as reliable. So in scenario two, she's more at risk. Her diabetes is a little more likely to go out of control, but she doesn't have significant resources. Scenario three, she's got the digital coach, but she's got the community health worker who comes to her home and helps support her in terms of activity and nutrition being among the most significant things that enables Mary to keep the diabetes and glucose levels appropriate. And then in scenario four, she is her own medical home, and she has a digital coach. She has access to care when she needs it, but she doesn't need it as much, and since she's paying out of pocket, she uses the digital health coach and the Patients Like Me, SNPs Like Me diabetic network to self-manage.
Dr. Beasel, you talk about one of the tools that's going to greatly reduce health disparities is biomonitoring, and you also talk about the future of healthcare where food will be as much a part of a treatment regime as medicines are, and that evidence-based nutrition information will increasingly become part of the future patient care protocol. And then, of course, genomics. So talk to us about these game changers and how they fit into the next larger context of healthcare of the future.
In genomics, and our gene fingerprint will be really important. Equally important will be our zip code and the social determinants of health of where we live. And we'll come to understand the role that our community conditions fit the genomics piece is we will increasingly understand the genome. It'll be low cost to map it. We'll be able to have it in our medical records. At the same time, we'll come to understand whether you have a gene, whether it expresses, is the function of other factors beyond your genome itself, and that will get integrated. The food question becomes really important, both because we all uptake our food very differently, but food is essentially the quantity of calories, the nature of calories, all of those become very important. The biomonitoring will take a number of forms. We'll have bed pads that we just sleep on and get a lot of what a sleep lab tells us about our sleep quality. We'll have wristwatches or earrings or eyeglasses that we basically understand heart rate variability. We will come to map that with biomonitoring, but we'll also understand our food intake, what difference it makes for us. Our systems will also say, do you have access to healthy food? Is your neighborhood safe? Are you socially isolated? And how do you understand that? So individually and more collectively, we will focus on understanding those things and on acting on them.
Great. And Dr. Bisalt, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
I would look at community health centers and this notion of leveraging the social determinants of health and what it means for healthcare providers to do that. I think the food and nutrient question will be relevant. The future of Doc Watson as one example of what will become the digital health coach, but there'll be other competitors as well, and watch that in terms of what's happening. Those would be among the innovations, I'd say.
We're speaking today with Dr. Clement Bisalt, Chairman and Senior Futurist at the Institute for Alternative Futures. Dr. Bisalt, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Mark and Margaret, as I'm sure you're aware, critics of the federal healthcare law have claimed that it's the largest tax increase in history. But we took a look at this and found that that would only be true in raw dollars, a rather useless measurement with no adjustment for inflation. Once we adjust for inflation, the tax increase drops to fourth place since 1968, with Ronald Reagan's 1982 tax increase taking first place. And if we use the best measurement, according to most tax experts, that's the increase as a percentage of gross domestic product, then the healthcare tax increases are smaller than most of those enacted since 1968. So here's how we measured the increases. We looked at tables from U.S. Treasury Department tax analyst Jerry Tempolsky, who has worked in both Republican and Democratic administrations. We used the tax increase for 2014, which is when the major provisions of the health care law take effect, and the largest figure Tempolsky has for the law. We compared that 2014 increase to the one-year figures for each tax increase since 1968. Now, keep in mind, these are estimates, and we also don't have figures for the years further out, but the healthcare law can't be the largest tax increase in U.S. history. We have to go way back to 1942 to find the largest, a tax hike of 5% of GDP used to pay for the country's war effort. The healthcare law would need to be about 12 times larger to come close to that. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When 22-year-old college student Ludwig Marashane was on an extended trip to Africa, he and his fellow students bemoaned the lack of available water to take a shower. The awareness of that very real problem, lack of water for basic hygiene in many parts of the world, got him thinking. What if there were a product that could take the place of a shower, that could perform the same task of cleansing that soap and water does? When he returned to the University of Cape Cod, he set to work. 6 months of research on biodegradable and antimicrobial products led to a unique invention simply called Drybath. And it's not just a rehash of hand sanitizer, which is made largely from alcohol and other chemical products. Marachain's odorless and biodegradable body bath gel is a proprietary combination of biocides, bioflavonoids, and moisturizers. The product has been shown to reduce bacteria by 99% and have a lasting antimicrobial effect. Already, there's keen interest from several sectors, including the airline industry, which sees the commercial value of providing the product for folks on long flights. And Marachain sees numerous potential applications, specifically having the potential to improve health and wellness through better hygiene in developing regions that lack basic access to bathing water. Drybath has earned Marachain the 2011 Global Student Entrepreneur of the Year Award. A simple, biodegradable gel that could improve hygiene for areas of the world lacking basic access to clean bathing water, potentially improving the general health of those communities as a result. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.